I'm Lardan Nushin. I'm based in the music department at City, University of London. I'm an ethnomusicologist. My research has primarily been on Iranian music of various kinds, Iranian classical music, Iranian popular music. I've also done a little bit of work on music in Iranian cinema.
And you were talking today about Iranian hip-hop and the urban musical imaginary. Before we get to the question of specifically hip-hop and its impact on Iranian culture, maybe could you explain a little bit about the kind of music that you might otherwise expect to encounter in Tehran?
The kinds of music you might encounter in Tehran, well, all kinds of music ranging from Iranian traditional music right through to various kinds of popular music, also Western music of various kinds, including classical music. So there's the Tehran Symphony Orchestra, for example. There are various music training centres where you can learn Iranian but also Western music. There isn't any what you might call Western popular music allowed in public, but there's plenty of popular music in a sort of Western style.
I was really interested in what you said in the paper about allowed musics in different sorts of spaces. So how much is that actually controlled by the government?
It's entirely controlled by the government in the sense that any public performance or recording has to get permission from the government. This isn't anything new. This dates back to before the revolution of 1979. But immediately after the revolution, there were various restrictions that came in specifically on certain kinds of Western popular music because of the way that it had been promoted before the revolution and had sort of become a symbol of the Shah's pro-Western modernising policy. So it was a kind of a reaction against that. Over the course of time, things changed, and from the late 1990s, Western popular music has become much less problematic and it's easier to get permission, or Western-style popular music, I should say. I mean, having said that, you can access any kind of music in Tehran, particularly amongst the kind of sort of wealthier, but also like the middle classes. Most people are connected to the internet, so even though the government tries to restrict access to certain kinds of websites and social media in particular, they focus a lot on things like political websites or pornographic websites. They're not that concerned with things like music websites. So it's fairly easy to access all kinds of material through the internet. A lot of people have satellite television, for example.
And so what is the specific role of hip-hop as a kind of cultural movement, something that you were discussing in your paper?
So hip-hop in Iran emerged in the early 2000s as part of a broader underground alternative youth popular music movement, which had been there before the early 2000s, but I think there were various factors, including in 1997, a more liberal president, President Khatami, was elected to power. So there were all kinds of, the cultural sphere more generally eased up. There were less restrictions. Also, that sort of coincided with, so the internet arrived in Iran in the early 90s. After Israel, it was the first country in the Middle East to get the internet, actually, to get access to the internet. But by the late 1990s, early 2000s, it was fairly widespread. And there were lots of internet cafes as well as domestic access to the internet. So all of that meant that musicians, rock musicians, or other what came to be known as alternative or alternative in Persian music genres. So there was this sort of binary created between, if you like, kind of mainstream bubblegum pop and what was seen as more serious alternative music genres. So rock, metal, and then hip-hop emerged around 2003 in Iran. It had started off in diaspora, and then some artists in Iran started working in it, and there's been a big explosion of hip-hop. I think it relates to, first of all, the centrality of poetry in Iranian culture. So there's a long tradition of poetry that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. So the lyrics being important, I think that was one thing. And it also became a medium for talking about things that didn't have a forum for being expressed previously.
And you talked in your paper a lot about Hechkas, one of the first big rappers in Tehran. What kind of topics is Hechkas actually rapping about in his hip-hop?
As you'll have seen from the examples that I played, particularly he deals a lot with social inequality, social issues. He deals a lot with issues around national identity and claiming a particular kind of national identity that is slightly different from that promoted by the government, in a way. I mean, this kind of relates to my own, what I was talking about, him sort of reclaiming or claiming the streets of Tehran. just to sort of clarify, my interest in Iranian hip hop really came out of broader work that I've done on Iranian popular music over the last 15, 16 years. So I've mainly worked actually on rock music, and a lot of my interviews and field work that I did was with rock musicians. And that's most of the work I've published has been on rock music. But I've got one book chapter on actually on a female hip hop artist. And really my motivation for talking about Heechkast today was another area of interest which I've got, which is in the city and the way that the city is represented, the way that the city is imagined. And I think Heechkast and other artists, but I decided to focus on him, show this very clearly because of the way that the city becomes a sort of character in its own right in his music videos. I suppose I'm just clarifying that I'm not an expert in hip-hop per se. I'm not a hip-hop studies scholar. I've come to this mainly through my broader work on Iranian popular music and my interest in the city. And in fact, that is the paper that I was going to have presented. I changed my topic. The paper that I was going to be presenting was based on recordings of the sounds of Tehran that I made last summer when I on my last fieldwork trip. This paper that I presented today brought together these two intersecting interests, one on Iranian popular music, but the other on Tehran as a sounded space and the ways in which people understand the urban environment through the sonic experience. Yeah, I'd say that Heechkast, like other artists, deals with all kinds of issues. I mean, there are some hip-hop artists that deal with... Somebody asked a question, for example, about gender issues. So there's a hip-hop artist called Shaheen Najafi who lives in Germany, who's dealt a lot with issues around women's empowerment, for example. There are not many, but there are a few female hip-hop artists. So the one that I've published on and I did field work with and so on has rapped about domestic violence, drug abuse. I mean, these are topics that were completely taboo in any form of popular music in Iran until hip-hop kind of became a space. And I guess because artists are also very much modelling themselves on hip-hop artists elsewhere, particularly in the US, that they feel like they are permitted in a way to deal with these kinds of issues. Actually, there have been one or two hip-hop artists have managed to get government authorization for their music, which is quite interesting. There's no law in Iran that says Western music or Western style music is prohibited, but in order to get permission, you have to submit an application to the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance. So you never really know until you've submitted it what is allowed and what isn't. I mean, the only thing that's absolutely specified and nobody would even bother submitting anything to the ministry is solo female singing. That's not allowed in public. Choral singing is fine. Solo female singing to all female audiences is fine, but not to mixed audiences.
This is really, really interesting and actually fascinating that you've done work on a female hip-hop artist, because certainly the kind of music that we heard in your session, it is pretty kind of ultra-masculine.
Absolutely,
quite aggressive,
yeah.
Both in terms of the way that it's performed, but also the way that the videos are put together as well.
Yeah.
It's a very kind of macho image.
Yeah.
Given that solo female performance is not allowed, how are these female hip-hop artists
working?
Well,
solo female singing. I mean, what's very interesting is actually, particularly in the classical music, there is a young generation of instrumentalists who are now coming out of the university. And I think within a generation or two, there's going to be some very high-profile female instrumentalists. And when I've asked people locally, they say this isn't the case, that these women would have gone and studied instruments anyway. Part of me feels that the restrictions on singing has sort of encouraged women to take up instruments rather than singing. Although privately, people still study singing. There are plenty of female singers in Iran. Some of them post their material online. I mean, that's something I'm writing about at the moment, actually, is the internet as a sort of space for female performers who don't have a sanctioned public space in Iran. Sorry, I just thought I'd clarify there, because sometimes people kind of broadly say, you know, female women are not allowed to perform in Iran, and that's not the case at all. And there are some very talented instrumentalists now sort of emerging.
But interesting that it's specifically singing that they're not allowed to do, and yet hip-hop, because of the nature of the genre, allows you to subvert that.
Yes, but female hip-hop artists, they would still consider that to be singing. I mean, hip-hop isn't sanctioned anyway, whether by male or female artists, other than, as I say, there are one or two cases of artists who, for inexplicable reasons, have managed to get... I mean, there's one artist who has a very laid-back rapping style. It's a kind of poppy hip-hop, so maybe that's why it was allowed, because it wasn't very kind of aggressive and quite physical. And I'm trying to think of the topics that the rappers sang about, but I think, you know, obviously lyrics are very important because the government doesn't want anything that could be seen to be criticising them. So the first example I played in my paper today, which was talking about social inequality, one could interpret that as being directed. It's not explicitly directed at the government and it's not explicitly political, but you could say because it's pointing out economic inequalities, it's pointing the finger at the regime. Not that there weren't inequalities before the revolution, there certainly were, but yeah, suggesting that perhaps the government should be doing something about it. I think one of the things that's really fascinated me about all of this is, and I've been teaching a course on global popular musics this last year, so we touched on this a bit in my teaching as well, is how hip-hop has spread so much globally. I think there's almost nowhere in the world now that doesn't have some form of local hip-hop expression. So there are questions about what it is about hip-hop that has made it be adaptable to local circumstances. And I think particularly work I've seen amongst not just ethnomusicologists, but cultural studies people and so on, certainly I think what seems to be the case is that it's the conscious rap themes that seem to have been taken up by many artists in other parts of the world rather than the sort of gangster rap or other kinds of rap. So you don't get the same amount of explicitly misogynistic themes that you might, or the violence and so on. From what I've seen, I don't think that's just the case in Iran. I think in Iran it's certainly the case that probably 80 or 90% of hip-hop is very much socially conscious and it's social themes that it's dealing with. And I think that's the case from what I've seen of hip-hop amongst Aboriginal people in Australia or in Argentina or Vietnam. It's a similar thing. So there's something about the way that artists around the world perceive those kinds of almost mythic roots of hip-hop as having come out of a situation where people have sort of empowered themselves through that particular music genre. So those are the social meanings that that particular style of music has taken on. And so those are the themes that tend to get rapped about. I mean, there's a danger of me overgeneralising. There probably is some misogynistic First Nations hip-hop somewhere. But I think generally speaking, I think that's the case. And I think that's interesting for all kinds of reasons, yeah.
You said you spent a long time working on Iranian music, on music in Tehran, on popular music in Iran. What is it about the music and culture of that area that has attracted you as a research area?
Well, I guess one gets attracted to particular areas for personal reasons, if nothing else. So I have a family connection to Iran. I was born in the UK, but my parents are from Iran. So I just came up through a standard Western classical training. I did a very, very Western classical undergraduate degree, and then I went on to study ethnomusicology. And at that time, we didn't really have much Iranian music around us at home, so I wasn't that familiar with it, actually. At that point, I was actually really interested in Latin American music because I had a teacher at school who had some Chilean friends and I'd been exposed to that music and I'd actually really fallen in love with it. And that's really what I wanted to study. But I was sort of steered towards Iranian music in a way because I had the language. I didn't speak Spanish, which of course I could easily have learned. But somehow I decided that I would go in that direction and I ended up writing a master's dissertation on Iranian classical music. And then I went on to do a PhD, which is about improvisation in Iranian classical music. And at that point, I had been to Iran once as a young child, but then not at all for all kinds of reasons related to the politics of the revolution happened and then it was difficult to travel and so on. So I first went to Iran other than once when I was about 5 years old. I then went back in 1999 after 30 years, not really knowing what to expect, except that I guess I had always had this idea of it as being somewhere that I kind of belonged to, because I didn't really feel that I belonged in England, even though I'd been born and brought up here. It was this kind of feeling of not really knowing where I belong. So it's interesting to think about the motivations why we go and research the things that we do. But I think for me, it was probably a kind of rather cliched search for roots, actually. It was probably a search for somewhere that I felt I belonged. But ironically, of course, although I went to Iran in 1999, I'd already been doing some research with diaspora Iranians in London. And then I went to Iran and there was so much music happening, so much interesting stuff happening. I thought, this is what I want to write about. I mean, I fell in love with the country, but at the same time, so I was brought up in Guildford in Surrey. My father taught at the university and I think I was the only foreign child in my whole school. And I used to have this thing about how it would feel to walk down the street and not look different from other people. I mean, I live in London now, it's all multicultural and so on, but it was very different kind of growing up in a very white part of Surrey. When I went to Iran, I thought I'd just like walk down the street and I'd just be like anybody else and I wouldn't stick out or be different. But actually, as soon as I opened my mouth, I was different. And even the way I walk, I think people notice, or the way you dress, you know, immediately you're marked out as different. even though it was a kind of a homecoming for me, I still didn't feel that I belonged in the way that I perhaps had hoped. But yeah, I fell in love with the country, and I think one thing that really motivated me was the contrast between the country that I found, which was people were so hospitable, it's a very warm culture, there's such a long history, there's a lot of poetry everywhere. You turn on the radio and there's poetry, streets are named after poets, taxi drivers quote poetry, everything feels very rooted. There's a real stark contrast between the Iran that I found there and the Iran that you kind of see on the media outside. And I think it wasn't like I kind of felt I had a duty, but I almost thought, well, I really want to write about this so people really know what's happening. And in fact, in 2008, I took a group of students from City University. I took six students to Iran on a sort of an educational trip. They're all music students, five undergraduates and one PhD student. And we did a mixture of sort of sightseeing. We went to see historical sites. We went to Persepolis. And we also met musicians. We went to concerts. And we spent half a day at the University of Tehran meeting with them, meeting Iranian music students, which was great, actually. I think for me, that was the highlight. So this is all a very long way, I guess, of talking about how I came to work on this and why, for me, it's very important, because it's not just about presenting a different side to Iran, but it is about making Iran better known, or the side of Iran, I guess, that people don't necessarily hear about.
Yeah, kind of delving into the culture in enough detail that it doesn't just become a particular media image, as you say.
Yes.
Given the fact that there was this long gap between your having been there as a child because of political events and all the rest of it, it seems timely that we're doing this interview now at a point where British Airways is about to start doing direct flights back there again, the first UK carrier to be doing direct flights since 2012, I think it is. In terms of the logistics as a researcher of going there, when there haven't been direct flights, when there is an external perception of what an unsettled place it is, how has that affected your own experience as a researcher working there, but also how your research has been perceived by, say, institutions or funding bodies, the idea of you travelling to Iran?
No, that's a good question. There have been direct flights in the sense that, so when British Airways stopped flights, you could still get there on British Midland, who then later stopped. But Iran Air flies direct. So when I went last year, I flew direct, except that because of the sanctions, they couldn't refuel in the UK, which means when you fly to Iran, they have to stop somewhere in Europe. I don't know why they can. We stopped in Prague, I think. So you just literally, you land, they refuel the plane with everyone on the plane. I'm not sure how safe that is, but anyway. And then it flies to Tehran. And I think, I don't know if they stopped doing that now. I mean, I gathered that since the sanctions have either entirely gone or are being reduced, that there are those practical issues. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that British Airways is reinstating direct flights. When I took the students, it was very interesting because I had to fill in a health and safety. I don't think I had to do an actual ethics form at that time, so it was 2008. As it happened, the head of health and safety at City University at that time was an Iranian. And so it was very helpful for me because I'd never filled in one of these things before. And he said, fine, leave it with me. And he helped me do it. But, you know, ironically, at that time, and possibly still, Iran is one of the safest places in the Middle East to be now. And certainly the students who came with me, they said, we feel safer here than we do walking down the street in Dalston or wherever they happen to live. Again, there's this contrast between the perception of it from outside as being a dangerous place to be and the reality of it actually in the context of the Middle East. As I say, it probably is the safest place to be. And I've been in touch with various people, Europeans who've travelled. There's a woman, a travel writer who travels around on motorbike, Lois Price, who's about to publish a book of her travels to Iran. And she's travelled all over the world on her motorbike. And about 3 years ago, she went to Iran for the first time and spent 3 weeks motorbiking on her own around the country. And she's been back twice since. Like a lot of people from Europe or America who go, she actually fell in love with the country. People were so hospitable. They were inviting her into their homes and all of that. There is that contrast. Last year, when I went, I had to do an ethics form for City University. That was quite difficult because I had to convince the university that it was safe for me to go. And given that the Commonwealth Office advice is always overly cautious, that was quite hard.
Do you think it makes it more difficult, less difficult, as difficult, the fact that you are a female researcher wanting to travel solo to Iran to do this work?
Yeah, I don't think it makes any difference as a researcher for the kinds of research that I do. If I was researching women's music, I mean, I have done some work on women's groups before, and that was definitely an advantage being able to get into that space compared with had I been a male researcher. But for most of the research that I've done, it hasn't been particularly gender sensitive. Because a lot of what I'm doing, so interviews and so on, are happening in private spaces, there aren't the sensitivities as to meeting someone of the opposite sex outside, interviewing them. Although actually, having said that, last summer when I went, I did a lot of my interviews in an outdoor cafe, and therefore I was meeting up with male interviewees, and that wasn't really a problem at all. I think if you go as a tourist, it's much more difficult because you have to be with a tour, you have to stay in particular hotels, and I don't know that you're allowed to move around so independently. I don't know if that's going to change. I mean, 2008, when I took the students, it was no problem at all. We could go wherever we wanted. But I think there have been some restrictions brought in. I think one of the interesting things about the dynamics of hip-hop in Iran in terms of its relationship to the sort of local global nexus, that's a problematic binary, but if we just kind of for the moment, because it's a music genre that has come in from outside Iran, it's taken on a sort of local expression, and that's partly what I was talking about today. The role of the images of Tehran is very much to ground it in the local. I didn't talk about this today, but it's not even just Tehran, but it's particular parts of Tehran that artists identify with, which then gives it a strong local identity. And then, of course, because of one of the main ways of reaching audiences, both primarily within Iran, but then also to the diaspora, to the Iranian diaspora, and then non-Iranians outside, the internet is one of the main means now, partly because of restrictions within the country, means that it takes on a more global dimension. So one of the arguments I'm making is that despite the global circulation, what ties it to the local are the images that, and to some extent the lyrics that are being used. So it's not coincidental that so much of Hechkas's work showcases the city and different images of the city. That's what I'm arguing, is that that becomes a way of validating it, not just as authentic hip-hop, because it's on the streets, as they see authentic hip-hop, I guess in its kind of original manifestation, but also authenticates it as something that is Iranian, or specifically Tehrani, actually, because most rappers really are operating in Tehran.
And interesting then that one of the other videos that you showed was a collaboration between Hechkas and Reveal, yes, who's London-based.
Yes, yes.
But he was actually in Tehran for the filming of that video.
Yes. Reveal is he's Iranian-born, but he moved to the UK when he's very young. And he's very interesting. So he's a British-Iranian rapper, very involved in the UK hip-hop scene, and has, for most of his teens, was entirely involved in sort of London hip-hop with very little connection with Iran. He was rapping in English. And then he started returning to roots, started to work with artists in Iran. He travelled to Iran after a period when he wasn't able to and started working with artists there. So one of the examples I showed, he's collaborated with various artists, but particularly with Hechkas. So you get this very interesting kind of exchange where you get Hechkas rapping in Persian and then Reveal responding or sometimes translating what he's said into English, not just English, but a kind of street English, and then whole sections where he's rapping about his own experiences as an Iranian having been brought up on a council estate in North London. So again, you get that kind of local global tension there. And now, in fact, because Hechkas now lives in London and they've been doing some work together there. So Hechkas, interestingly, partly through his sort of friendship and connection with Reveal, has now become sort of plugged into the UK hip-hop scene. So he's only been in London, I think, for about 3 years. So it'll be interesting to see how that impacts on his work. He hasn't been back to Iran since, so...
Wow, that's a long time to not be there, having worked so hard to kind of bed that down.
And for many, many years, he absolutely insisted that he wouldn't leave. But it was the fallout from the 2009 film, No One Knows About Persian Cats, and then the presidential elections. He left soon after the presidential elections. I think he went to Malaysia originally. He didn't come straight to the UK, but anyway, ended up in the UK.
So given this, we really have a theme within hip-hop getting to Tehran in the first place, and then what's happened to some of these artists since, of globalisation, kind of cosmopolitan approaches, political tensions, internal and external ideas of what a particular city or country might be like. So given the fact that this situation is absolutely not unique to Iran, how important do you think the ethnomusicological approach is now for understanding musical culture all around the world?
Well, I guess it depends how you define the ethnomusicological approach. It's very hard to answer that question because I think the boundaries, quite rightly, and I'm very pleased that those kinds of boundaries between, well, if we take musicology and ethnomusicology as one particular binary where one could make that distinction entirely blurring. So if I say that ethnomusicological approach looks at music in its social cultural context, that's something that many musicologists do as well. And if I say that it's about understanding the place of music in people's lives and also getting their perspective, so understanding the meaning of music in people's lives and accessing that through the ways in which they talk about their own relationship with music, whether that's artists or just ordinary people, then of course many musicologists are doing that now. I mean, the methodological challenges are, I'm trying to understand, in this particular case, for this paper, you know, what is the significance of the city? What role does this music video play in the ways in which the city is imagined by audiences and viewers? So any challenge of, or any attempt to understand audience perspective, traditionally with ethnomusicology, you sit down and talk to people. That rests on an assumption that, A, people tell you what they really believe, and of course, obviously, we're involved in understanding and deconstructing and trying to understand why people say what they say, not just taking what they say at face value, but also that there may be processes going on cognitively that people are not even aware of, and how do you access that? I probably need a music psychologist to help with that. So that's one side of the dimension. But I think this is a broader question, not so much for hip-hop studies, but actually where it intersects with media, film, music videos. So understanding mass audiences, particularly through the internet, you know, how do you access the audience who is sitting in the bedroom watching a music video online? How do you understand what sense they're making of it? So I don't have a real answer for that, except that these are big questions which I grapple with and many others are grappling with, and I think we do the best that we can.
One last question. You have used several times the word fieldwork to describe when you're actually going out to Iran to do research trips. So what kind of activities fall under the umbrella of fieldwork?
I use fieldwork as a broad term to mean immersing oneself in a particular environment. It's a sort of shorthand, I guess. So that's everything from sitting down with somebody and interviewing a composer or a performer or an audience member, right through to attending concerts, going to visit studios and observing rehearsals. It could involve even watching the music videos as a form of fieldwork in a way. But it's about being in that environment and understanding how people are experiencing things as well. So a more kind of general soaking in what's happening, walking the streets and seeing what music, what concerts are happening, posters. I mean, I spent a lot of time last summer in Tehran just recording sounds on the street, street musicians. There are a lot of street musicians now, but many more than there were before. So fieldwork sort of includes all of those things, really.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed.